Thank you, Nancy. When I finally got here yesterday, and the first person I saw was Nancy, and she shrieked and hugged, and I knew I was home, and I was comfortable, and that smile made it worth getting up at 3 a.m. and getting here. She's just a blessing in my life. We've known each other for a long time, thanks to that wonderful invention of Facebook. But it's so nice to be able to come and see each other, and it's just like, sis, she's my sister, really. I mean, it's like we don't see each other, but when we do, it's just, amazing. I also want to thank Julie, the wonderful Julie, for picking me up from the airport, and she had all these healthy snacks, and yeah, I'm a junk food person, but I'm trying to change. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. I want to thank Jason for asking me to speak. I don't care what anyone says. Where are you? I don't care what anyone says. You're pretty okay. You know, it's so funny because my sponsor always sends me something before I speak, and it's usually, and typically again today, it was get out of the way, be the pipe, and carry God's message. I came in here, and Jeff grabbed me, and said, do you want to pray? And I was so thankful because usually if I have my sponsor, sponsees, you know, we do that. And it was so wonderful that he grabbed me and we spent that moment before I came up here so that I could get out of the way so something worthwhile may be able to happen today. And then Jason says, don't screw it up. So, thank you. Yes, thank you also to the committee. I am involved in a conference back in Bismarck, North Dakota, which you're all welcome to come. It's called Rule 62, and we have it in the middle of January. So please come. I don't know why that's, you know, we have nothing else to do. Why not? You know? So I know the amount of work that goes into this. Seriously, it takes a tremendous amount of work, and I always admire what goes on behind the scenes, and the fact that it just seems to go off seamlessly shows me how much work goes on behind the scenes, and I want to thank you for that. Also want to thank you for this wonderful balmy summer weather. For me, it is. This is fantastic. I get to come here and thaw out. What is it, 45 degrees? I don't know. This is summer. So thank you for that. I think I remembered my manners here now. My name is Judith Roberts, and I am an alcoholic. I want to give you a little bit of my stats. I am the baby of the group this weekend. I got sober. My sobriety date is January the 19th, 2009. So this January, I celebrated 10 years. And that applause is for you in this amazing program of recovery. I think it's a big deal. I never stayed sober for longer than 3 days when I was drinking. That was the longest I ever stayed sober. And so I cannot believe to this day, 10 years, that is absolutely not me. Absolutely, I'm incapable of that. And so I am very, very grateful. I have a sponsor. I have a who knows that he's my sponsor. I regularly use my sponsor. I have a grand sponsor that I know. I know them both very, very well. And what I love about them, my sponsor has 3 years more than me, and my grand sponsor has like 30 years. And I was in the same home group as them every morning at 6:45 a.m. and for my first part of my sobriety. And what I can say about them is they led by example. And they didn't tell me told me what to do. And not kindly either sometimes, I thought. But more than that is they showed me. They never said, go do this. They said, come with me. And they've been walking with me ever since. And what I love about them is that they're both as enthusiastic as any newcomer I've ever seen. They both still go to detox. They both still go to jails. They both still sponsor multitude of people. They both take out butt cans and sweep and put out chairs. And I love that about especially my grand sponsor with 30 years. He is as full of joy and enthusiasm for this program as anyone I've ever seen, and he has what I want. I want to be 30 years sober, and I want to be like that. And so I get to follow by example. I also have the privilege of working with a multitude, not a multitude, sorry. It seems like a multitude. They just, women, drama, It's not a multitude. I get the privilege of working with women in sponsoring and guiding them, and it has become the bright spot in my life, the bright spot. And I tell you that I have a sponsor and a grand sponsor and sponsees, not for any, you know, ego trip or lineage or anything like that, but why that's important to me is because it's like my grand sponsor and my sponsor, they're like the train engines. And I came along one day and I hooked my little car on the back of them, right? And they're pulling me. And that's exactly what they did early in sobriety. They pulled me through a lot in early sobriety. But you know, the funny thing is that it's fairly easy to unhook your little car, you know? Until other little cars hook their car to your car, right? And they're pushing me, they're hooking on, and they're pushing me, and I'm being pulled. I get to follow that example, and I get to lead by example, and I'm right where I'm supposed to be, smack dab, in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's the only place I'm safe. So, I have a home group. My home group's called the Three Legacies, and we go through the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, and the 12 concepts, and that meets on Thursday at 7 p.m., so if you're ever in North Dakota, no one ever takes me up on this, but you're welcome to come by. It's a great little meeting, and it's amazing because we have the majority of the people in that meeting are a year and under. Can you believe that? Who, I never at a year was interested, yeah, okay, the steps, that's cool, whatever. But the traditions and the concepts, and yet the room, you know, we have 30 to 40 people, and most of them are a year under, and they are hungry for the answers. They are hungry for answers in a world that everything is watered down. And it's an amazing thing, and I love being able to participate. I love being able to participate with you guys this weekend. Anything I get to do in AA is a privilege because it saves my life over and over. And I love the first speaker. I don't know where you are. Thank you. Ronald, I love that. And McDonald's. That was so cool. And he made me cry, and I'm like, oh my God, get it together. I loved, now I just lost it, but it was really good. Oh my God. But thank you. Thank you for starting this. Oh, I know. It was how you ended. Thank you for doing a 12-step call on me today. And that's what it's all about. I'm not from Bismarck, North Dakota. Did I give all my stats? I think I did. I'm not from North Dakota. I was raised in Australia. My father's Australian. My mom's American. So I always say that I'm half and half. And I'm just baffled. I've gone through my life baffled. You know, whether I'm up here, down under, I don't know what's going on. I hear a lot of people say that, you know, they never felt like they fit in. I didn't know where in was. I didn't know where that ballpark was. But I did have the fear of missing out. No matter where I was sure that somewhere else was better. And if I was with someone, someone over there is more cool. So I did have that aspect of it. But I was raised in a very, very strict, growing up. My father has a doctorate in theology. No higher power issues here. You know, we'll get into that. My parents have never had a drop of alcohol. I can't find anyone from them on up for five generations. I'm a fifth generation convict from Australia. My great-great-grandmother and grandfather were both convicts, shipped over from England, and that's how my family ended up in Australia. I'm an attorney, so I didn't, you know, criminal attorney, same difference type of thing. I'm kidding. Not really. but for five generations back, the only person I can find, you know, if I'm looking for how, why am I this way? Why am I this way? Was my great-great-grandma, the convict, because I've got all the court documents over from England, and in the court documents it had multiple arrests for public intoxication and prostitution. And then comes me, five generations later. So, but from her to me, there's no sign. And to this day, like I said, my parents have never had a drop. I was not raised around it. I was never exposed to it. There was no alcohol anywhere around me. In Australia, it's very, very common to send your children away to boarding school. So at 13, I was sent away to boarding school. Again, a very controlled environment. And I never was around it, ever, ever. The funny thing is there's five of us kids. I'm number four. Five siblings, number three and number four, me, are alcoholic. And the other three aren't. You know, and I could spend a whole lot of time in asking why. But it doesn't really matter. There is no answer for me. What matters to me is now what? What do I do? Well, my first drink, first of all, can I ask, is there anyone here that's a year or under, Oh my God, thank you. Thank you for being here. I'm more comfortable talking to you guys because I too am the baby on the block. And if you hate us, welcome. If you're hostile, fantastic. And if you hate this whole God thing, excellent. You are where you need to be, because that was me. So welcome. So I'm just going to talk to you all. Okay, so my first drink, believe it or not, I know it's unusual, and don't turn me off when you hear this, okay? Because it's like, oh, whatever. But I didn't have, I didn't touch alcohol. My first drop of alcohol was when I was 28 years old. I know. People can say 11 and they're like, uh-huh, yep. 28, it's like, oh my God. 28, yes. And my first drink was very, very innocent. See, I was very, very much, I grew up, my parents are still together. I had, you know, very, very religious. I was in boarding school. I then married. I came to America. I went to North Dakota when I was 18. I was there for a month, met a little local farm boy, and within a month, I was engaged. A few months later, I was married. I thought I was going to be Laura Ingalls. I always wanted to be Laura Ingalls, and I ended up living in a house on the prairie. It was summer. I had no clue what was coming, right? No clue. Oh my gosh. So I was 18, and I was married, and I went from a city of 3.5 million to a town of 350 people, living out on the prairie. I'm 18, culture shock. And my whole life revolved around learning to drive tractor. I actually did that and all the time, and animals and all that cool stuff. And then church. I mean, that was my life. And I'm that nerd, I guess. I taught Sunday school. At 18, I was the youth group leader. Talk about crazy, having an 18-year-old being in charge of all the other teenagers. I did, you know, my entertainment was potlucks. I mean, at 18, 19, 20, this is what I did, right? We weren't allowed to dance. We weren't allowed to smoke, swear, have sex. Before marriage, I made up for all of that later. So that was my life. And my first drink was when I was 28 years old, and it was a very, very innocent drink. I had a guest in my home, and they had what I now know is vodka. And they said, you know, let's have a drink. And they had orange juice, and they put the vodka in the orange juice, and they gave it to me. And I remember taking a sip, and I remember saying, I mean, okay, I love Starbucks, right? And I love Diet Coke. I don't remember my first Diet Coke, and I don't remember my first Starbucks. I'm 54 right now, and this was when I was 28, and I remember it as clearly as it was yesterday, right? That's not normal. That's not normal, apparently. That's what normal people tell me. This is not normal. I asked them, do you remember your first drink? They don't. They look at me crazy. But anyway, so I remember having that first swig, and I distinctly remember saying, this tastes disgusting. This is foul. We just ruined a perfectly good glass of orange juice. Now I know why people don't drink. But while I'm saying that, sentence after sentence, I'm taking another drink. And now, with the knowledge I have now, looking back, it is clear to me from day one, I never drank for the taste of it. Ever. Ever. It's an acquired taste. I would have told you that I did later on, but I know the truth. It's like Brussels sprouts. I mean, who eats that, you know? But hey, if they gave me the same effect as alcohol, I'd be all about Brussels sprouts, right? But it ain't for the taste of it. So I had my first drink, and as I'm saying these things, I'm taking another drink. And taking another drink. And I'm down in that glass. And you all know what happens next. It went down. And it coated every raw nerve ending in my life. That spring eased up, and for the first time in my life, I had that great exhale. And the voices went quiet. And everything was so good. It was so good. And I've used this illustration before. The only way I mean, this is how I describe it. You know, in those the spy movies or the thief movies or whatever, and then the thief is coming in to the place, and they're wanting to crack a safe, and they're using the stethoscope thingy, and they're putting it up on the safe, and they're listening. They're turning that knob this direction till they hear that click of the tumbler, and then they turn it that way till they hear the click. They turn it that way, hear the click, and then they open it up. That's how it was for me. It was like the tumblers of my life just went click, 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 and a whole new world opened up. It was like the genie came out of the bottle. Little did I know I was going to climb into that bottle, and I was going to live there from 28 to 44 in the circumference of that bottle. Because, you know, they talk about that invisible line that we cross. Right? And we don't know when or where or whatever. I know my invisible line. It's right here. As soon as it crossed right here, I was gone. It was not gradual. It was not slow or gradual. It was on. Within a year, I was divorced from that very, very good man. No reason. I remember when I'm leaving, and he's standing in front of me. He had tears running down his eyes, and he asked me a very hard question. Why? As I'm walking out. And I looked at him with a look that I have now seen on a lot of people's faces. I get the privilege of doing a lot of 12-step calls, and I see that. And I see it on people's faces who are in here and are on their way out. And you're like, why stay? And it's this hard look. It's this, the disease had me in its grip. I have seen that look, and that look is dead hard eyes and a blank face. Because I had no reason why. I could not say one word. There was no reason why. I'm throwing away a perfectly good marriage. Within a year, alcohol was my master from the beginning. It was not gradual. People say that they lost this, that, the other thing to alcohol. Not my experience. I gladly served them up on a silver platter. If you got between me and alcohol, you're going to lose. I will go through you, around you, over you, whatever I have to do. But this liquid was my master, was my God. I exchanged my faith from that moment on. Well, not only was I divorced, but I was excommunicated out of the church. If you don't know what that means, it means like you're sitting around like this, and they take a vote. Should we kick her out? Yes or no? Yes. Raise your hand. I was out of the club. And so from that moment on, too, from that first drink, I turned my back on my faith, God, my husband, my family, my friends, my community, and very quickly, my dignity, my self-respect, and my morals. It wasn't that I had low morals. It was that I had none. I went from teaching Sunday school, youth group leader, being raised knowing right from wrong, doing all that, church four times a week, all that stuff, to someone you would not even recognize. There was no line that I didn't cross. You put something in front of me, I'd say, okay. Anything to chase what I had experienced in those first days of drinking, anything. At 40, drugs are introduced into my story. Who does that? Who picks up at 40 years of age? I mean, seriously. Only an alcoholic that is absolutely gone. So from 40 to 44, I had a love affair with cocaine. And that was just to drink longer and faster. You know, it's like, hi, I'm fine. Talk really fast and drink really fast. But in a way, I'm very, and you know what? I was introduced to it by other attorneys and politicians. Yeah, I know that should scare us a little bit. But I'm very grateful for that because after that was introduced, I lasted just four more years, from 40 to 44, and it took me down very, very quickly. I'm very grateful today for that. But so within a year, I'm divorced, excommunicated. I'm living, in a spot with this cot and everything. But I start building my life. Because at that point in time, I am a functioning, if you want to call it, functioning alcoholic. And I can go to college, and I can get a law degree, and I can hold down a job. Simply, I can do that because I want the money to buy what I need to buy to drink. So that was my life. And it went on like that from 28 to 44. In that time, I got married again. and took another guy through hell. He's a normie. Talked him into doing a geographic. My first geographic was when we quickly got married. You know, I don't date. It's like we meet, I pull up the U-Haul, move in. Then I get to know you. I'm very, very blessed, though. I've been married to two wonderful, wonderful men of character and integrity, both normies, both with the misfortune of being exposed to me. But I married him, and the first geographic I did was when we got, because I married him. He had come out of a divorce. I met him, and I was a limo driver putting myself through college. He was in the back of the limo, and that's how we met. And he was out. You know, he was a new divorce person, and he was out in the bars, and he was out. And I was like, this guy's so much fun. And he had a Harley, and what else do you need? And so we got married, and then we got married very quickly, and he said, okay, now it's time to, you know, be responsible adults. We need to settle down. And I was like, what? I just got out of that. I'm not getting back into that, right? And so immediately my drinking went down underground again, and I did my first geographic. I left and went for 3 years and went to law school. I don't remember my third year of law school at all. And that is where my third year of law school is when I became a daily drinker. Absolutely, from that point on, there was one time each year for 3 days where I did not have any substance in my body, alcohol or drugs. And that was because I'd go and help out at a Lakota ceremony. And for some reason, there was such a powerful spirit there that I didn't suffer. And the amazing thing was, is every year after those 3 days and being in that environment and just the amazing power that was there that I did not understand or believe in, I was just helping, I felt fantastic after 3 years. No withdrawals, no nothing. I felt fantastic. And as I was leaving every year, I'd be driving home and I'd be like, this feels great. I'm not going to drink. I'm going to make this last. And I had to drive. I was living in South Dakota at that time. And I'm jumping ahead a little bit. I'll explain how I got there. But I would drive home an hour and a half back to where I lived. And I didn't know anything about the disease of alcoholism. I had no idea about the obsession of the mind. But as I was pulling out of there, I'm promising myself, I'm going to keep this feeling. I'm not going to drink for a while. And as the miles would roll down, it would be like, well, you know, tomorrow's Sunday. You don't have to be at work till Monday. You know, you may as well, you know, it's been 3 days. I'm like, no, we're not drinking. But as the miles would go, all those things that I wanted for myself, all those reasons that I had come up with that I'm not going to drink, I've never felt so good all year long, all of a sudden they're supplanted by this other idea that comes along parallel. And all my logic, all my sound reasoning is pushed aside and I have no mental defense to it at all. And my car, when I pull into town, my car goes straight to the liquor store. And I'm only going to have one. Of course, I buy 5 bottles, whatever. At that point in my life, I was drinking one thing, you know, a thing that big of vodka a day or 4 or 5 bottles of wine a day. And that was my daily. That's not partying. That's daily. And so I buy all these bottles, but I'm just going to have one drink, and I'm going to hold on to how good I feel. But I also don't know, so I didn't know about that mental obsession, that I have no mental defense, even when I want to, even when I want to hang on to something good, I have no mental defense, and I'm going to do it again. And then I'm just going to have one, and when I take that one, I don't know that I'm alcoholic. And I don't know that when I ingest alcohol, it affects me different than any, 90% of the population. I have never been around alcoholics before. I've never been around it. And I don't understand that when I take one drink and any amount of alcohol into my body, it triggers this abnormal reaction that I have to alcohol, and I need another and another and another, and I don't have an off switch, and I only quit when I run out or I pass out or when I'm somehow stopped. I don't know that. And I'm off again. And I can't even keep that one little promise to myself. I can't hold on to this amazing feeling. My idea of an alcoholic was this old dude, has no teeth, coveralls, lives under a bridge, and drinks and in a paper bag, has the drink hidden in the paper bag. That's an alcoholic. That's not me. I don't think I look like an alcoholic. I'm a professional. I'm highly educated. I don't have a problem. Alcohol's not my problem. Never once. People talk about denial. It's no denial. I was in complete delusion. I have no concept of what an alcoholic is or what alcoholism is or what the problem is. I think the problem is you, the job, the relationship, whatever. But it certainly isn't alcohol. Alcohol is my solution. Alcohol is my God at that point. So, how did I get to South Dakota? Oh, my first geographic was law school. I came back from law school, and I was like, all right, let's put this marriage together. You and me, babe, you know what we need? We need to just get away from everything and everyone. If it was just you and me against the world, we would grow together, and this would be wonderful. And so I talked this very good man into selling a very successful business and packing everything up, selling everything, and we moved to nowhere, Nebraska. In the middle of nowhere, because I can't get in trouble in Nebraska. Within a week, I was in trouble. I find my people wherever, and I only lasted in Nebraska from December until September, not even a year. And during that time was some of the worst. I was drinking absolutely for oblivion. I was absolutely miserable, and this guy was interfering in my life. He was being absolutely unreasonable. He would say things like, "Don't you think you've had enough?" I would say, "Be quiet and eat your cereal." No, I'm kidding. Old joke. But no, he was being unreasonable, and he was nagging me, and he was trying to control me, and I couldn't stand it, and I just was coming apart at the seams, and I was just drinking. I would go to court intoxicated. What you smell, someone that's been drinking, and the prosecutor would be, I'm a criminal defense attorney, by the way. And the prosecutor would be looking at me like, "Is your client intoxicated?" I'm like, "Yes, you better breathalyze him." But it's me, right? And I'm, it's, and that's what I did. I that's how I showed up in life. And after a really, really, really horrendous night, let me just cut this all short by saying I'm the kind of drunk that is selfish, self-centered. I don't see you. I don't see you. And I don't care if you're married to me or not, I don't see you. And all that matters is that alcohol. And I had had enough. And after one particular, I'm the type, the wife that, and we share in a general way, but I forget that I'm married. I forget to come home all night. I forget about you. And after one particular bad night, he finally is like the most healthy Al-Anon that's never been in Al-Anon before, but that I know. And he said, "I am not willing to stand by and let you and watch you kill yourself. I'm leaving for the weekend, and when I come back, I want you gone." So he left. I rented a mover, and the mover came, and I said, okay, I'll have that. Put him in the van, and then I saw his custom collector item Harley sitting there. And I said, and I'll have that too. And he wasn't riding it, so. I can say almost anything bad, but I say that part, and the riders are like, oh no. They get up and walk out. See, there's one going right now. That's it. So I took the Harley. I'm still making amends on that one, and I left. I had not told him that I had applied for a job in Pierre, South Dakota, and I had been accepted, and I was leaving anyway. And so I got there, and I continued to drink there on my own, and there was no one to stop me. And I had everything. I had the high price sports cars that I would trade out every year, because you know what? It wasn't doing it for me after a year. And I'd walk into the showroom floor and I'd say, I want that one, trade this one in. I forged the title on the Harley and bought myself a new one. I'm winning friends right now. I had everything you could, I had sports equipment. I lived right on the Missouri River from here to just like the 10th row. I plopped the kayak in there. I had mountain bikes. I had all the sports equipment. I had luxury apartment. I had a high, powerful, prestigious job. I had the possessions. I was the legal counsel for the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And I went to work every day in a window office, brass, marble, mahogany, mosaic tile floor. I had it all, and I was sitting in there, and I was living an absolute double life, because on the weekends I would have to leave Pier because I had too much of a visual, high-profile job. So I'd have to leave, so I'd go down to the reservation and get the illegal substances I needed and party like I needed to party, or I'd go to Rapid. But I had to go out of town, out of Pier, in South Dakota. So I would do that down on the reservation, and I'm living this double life. My last, and then working for the Chief Justice. my last run was Martin Luther King Jr. weekend. I had the weekend off, and I knew I had to get out of town because this was going to be a party weekend. And at this point, the party had been over 4 years. 4 years. And I am just drinking to be able to breathe. I cannot stand life. And I have all this stuff. You know, I'm the opposite from most stories, because everybody's like, yeah, I had nothing, and then I came to AA. I got a job, got the girl, got the guy, got the car, got the job. Life is great. I started out with all that and don't have the sports cars, don't have, the prestigious job, don't have the big paycheck, don't have anything. So if you want what I have, talk to me later. But I want to make one thing clear. I may not have the power, the prestige, and the possessions that I once had, but I am more free and more at peace and more happy than I have ever been in my entire life. And I never, yes, because of this program. And for you new people, I never believed it would happen. I never believed it could happen. After that, and I'm running out of time. Good God, I don't even know how much time I still have. You do that when, okay. I wear a watch just to give you guys, hope. I get into this and I don't have a clue what I'm doing. But but I do have more than I've ever had. It's not about the external, though many, many, many of us get all that external. But what I have internally is something I would never, ever exchange. Like the motto, no matter what. I would never exchange it, no matter what. Even when I don't have all peachy days, but no matter what, I would not exchange what I have today. I would never want to go back to that hell that I was living. That quicksand was all around. My master was alcohol. I was having those hallucinations. I was seeing things. I was sick all the time. But I'm not an alcoholic. Right? I just hate life. I don't drink in the morning, so I can't possibly have a problem. Never once did I question. I didn't know what was wrong. So my last drunk went to Deadwood, South Dakota, ended up waking up again, coming to somewhere that I didn't want to be again. And I grabbed my stuff and I got into my fancy sports car and squealed out of the parking lot and promptly ran into another vehicle. Now I'm in trouble for the first time. I drove drunk all the time. I have never gotten caught. I deserve to be in prison. I have done illegal things with drugs. I deserve to be in prison. But I never got caught. But I run into this car, and now I'm in trouble because I have illegal substances in my bloodstream, and I know I'm well over the illegal limit to drive. So what did I do? I did what any self-centered, selfish alcoholic would do, and I fled the scene. And as I was coming down the mountain, I don't know if you're familiar with Deadwood, but it's up in the little hills, Black Hills, and you're coming down to Rapid City. And as I was coming down, I had that moment of clarity. And I don't remember who it was. A friend said, described what that means to me really well. When he said, that moment of clarity is like when the liar in you shuts up enough for you to see the truth about yourself. The liar in me shut up enough for me to see the truth. And I looked and I was like, who are you? I'm that sang in the choir Sunday mornings, Sunday school teacher. I know better. And now, who are you? There was no line I hadn't crossed. Who are you? And I was coming down and there was I was really shaking and pulled into Rapid City, and there was a guy there that I used to drink with and do drugs with, and he had disappeared 2 months before, and I didn't know where he was. So I called him, and I said, hey, do you want to get together? I just would like someone to talk to on my way home. I still had 2.5 hours to go. And he said, sure. And I said, meet me in such and such a bar. It was 10:30 on a Sunday morning. Meet me at such and such a bar, and I'll be there waiting for you. It was 2-for-1, Bloody Mary. That's not drinking in the morning. That's breakfast. Okay? So I had 4 lined up because that's economical. And those are for me, not for him. He had to order when he came in. And he walked in, and my life changed. He was a very heavy, he's an alcoholic, raging alcoholic, but he also had a huge meth problem, and he looked like he did. But when he came in that door, it was like the sunshine followed him in, you know, or a wind machine, except he's bald. But a wind machine, you know, it's just like the sun. It's like, oh! And because I could hardly recognize him, he had transformed. I got to hear the other side, his side of the story later, years later, and what he was doing is 2 months before that, he had gone to AA. And he had been sober for 2 months. And that morning when I called him, he was sitting in what a great AA member is doing. He was sitting in a meeting that morning, that Sunday morning, and his phone vibrated. He looked down. He saw it was me. He didn't know what I wanted, but he knew what I needed. And he stepped out and took my call. And he showed up at 2 months sober, sat across from me while I drank in front of him, because by that time I'm shaken and I'm needing something. And he shared with me what he had been doing for the last 2 months. He 12-stepped me in a bar while I drank. I don't remember a word he said. But I love that line in the book where Bill opens the door and Ebby's there. and he's dressed in the and his shining eyes and the joy. And it was like I could not deny the evidence right in front of me because I knew him. I drank with him. We did other things, you know, the illegal things, right? I knew him, and I had never seen such a thing. And I wanted what he had, even though I didn't know what that was. So after that, I got in the car. I drove 2.5 hours drunk back to Pier, and that night, there was a meeting at 8 p.m., and it was, the liquor stores are closing. Monday I have off, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. They're closing soon. Liquor store? AA. Liquor store? AA. And to this day, I don't know how, other than maybe a higher power that I despised at the time. I don't know how my car got to AA that night. And I walked in intoxicated. I was still buzzed. I wasn't drunk, but I was intoxicated. But no one shunned me, and they stuck out their hand. Actually, I came late on purpose. And then when they were circling up to do the prayer, I was like, there is no way I despise anything to do with God. And I headed for the door. And thank God for, you know, the greeters are very important, but the leavers, I think, save lives. Like what I call leavers. Because there's this guy, Gary, and yes, he had coveralls on and no teeth. And I was like, he's an alcoholic. I know this. But he body blocked me, and he stuck out his hand, and he said, hi, my name's Gary, and from habit, I stuck out my hand, and then he wouldn't let go, and he led me over, and he said, do you have one of these books? And he took this book, and he stole my first big book from the club. And he said, take it home with you and read the first 164 pages. And he gave me a coin, a 24-hour coin, and I was like, do I have to give it back? I'm not sober. You know, I didn't know what I was supposed to do, but I went home and I was like, if I can earn this 24-hour chip, that proves I don't have a problem. I mean, who thinks that way? If I can stay sober for 24 hours, I don't have a problem. No, so I did. I stayed in bed the entire day. And I stayed sober. I knew if I got up, I would go to the liquor store. And I read the 164 pages that day. While I was shaking, while I was DTing, while I was seeing things, I didn't know that you could die from this. I didn't know what AA was. I thought it was American Airlines. We are going on trips. I don't know. But I read it, and when I finished, I snapped the book shut, and I threw it against the wall, and I said, that's the stupidest thing I'd ever heard in my life. That was my introduction. I hated AA. I hated people. I was hostile. I would not say I was an alcoholic. It would go around the circle. It would come to me, and I'd say, hi, my name's Judith. And then I'd glare at the other person like, what? You got a problem? It took me weeks but I came back every day. I never missed a day, never missed a night. 8 p.m. every night I was there. And I heard what you guys said. And I was like, I feel like that when I drink. And more importantly, I feel like that when I'm not drinking. Everyone says, don't you see what alcohol is doing to you? And had I had the language to tell my family, to tell my friends, to tell my multiple husbands, I would have said, but can't you see what it does for me? I can't breathe without it. I can't stand you without it. I heard your stories, and finally, after a couple weeks, it came around to me, and I could not deny that. And I didn't want to say it. I didn't want to say it because I knew somewhere, no one even told me this, but it's in the book, but I knew somewhere deep down inside me that I only had two alternatives, not choices. Choices are like, there's a door there. There's a door, 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 door. You have multiple choices of how to get out of this room. Alternatives are like being on a downward escalator. I'm going down, or I can turn and walk against it and go up. And if I say, well, I'm not playing your stupid game, I'm just going to stand here, well, I'm still going to go down. There's two alternatives. And I didn't want to say I was an alcoholic because I knew as soon as I admitted to the innermost part of my being that I was an alcoholic, I had two choices. One, to go drink myself to death, and I was quite prepared to do that. Or do your stupid steps. And I didn't want to because it had the word God. And I hated everything to do with that. But finally, it came around, and I said those most beautiful words to me. And before, trust me, I did not feel this way at the time. I wouldn't have wished this on my worst enemy. And now, to me, they're the most beautiful words, because at least I know what's wrong with me, and I know that there's a solution. And those words were, hi, I'm Judith, and I'm an alcoholic. Now, I wish I could say that at that point in time, I fell in love with you and everything was great, but it wasn't. I hated it. It was like all these stupid sayings, first things first, think, easy does it, whatever. It's like Mother Goose threw up all over the place. I don't know. I'm not getting it. And then I entered into the period that I like to say was I was stark raving dry. I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every night at 8 p.m. Didn't miss it. And I was dying of untreated alcoholism, and I was getting insane. That spring, I could not breathe. And I did have a program of recovery. I sat in my fancy office in my very expensive clothes with my sports car in the parking lot, and I would sit there and I would rock. Just don't drink. I would watch the clock and I would sit there and I would rock. Just don't drink. And they would bring the women prisoners over from the prison there, and they would come over. The gardens at the Capitol are very, very beautiful, and they have rose bushes, and they'd bring the women over, and they would tend the rose bushes, and I would look out of my office window in my fancy life, and I'd look out at those women prisoners in their orange, and I would envy them because they were more free than I was. I thought in my mind that at least their fight is over. At least their fight is over. And I envied them. I have no idea what time it is. what happened was, really quickly, is that I was miserable. I was dying, and I refused to do your steps. It was very small meetings where I lived in Pier, maybe 8, 10 old men, no teeth, overalls. Clearly alcoholic. I went to the meetings, and for that hour is the only hour in 23 hours I could breathe. For some reason, I felt safe with you guys, and that was my program, rocking during the day, sitting with you an hour a night, going home, doing it again, over and over and over. And I did that from January the 19th to right before Thanksgiving. In the middle of that time, I figured I must need a new job. I was offered a job. It must be this. It must be that. It's always external. That's the problem. I was offered a job with even more power, more prestige, more possessions. And that was being an assistant U.S. attorney. If you don't know, if you're not familiar, like Jason and my friend Richard with the federal court system, you don't want to be involved. Okay? You don't want to be involved with the federal system at all. And I was sworn in, raised my hand, swore to, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I was sworn in as an assistant U.S. attorney. And my job description was prosecuting violent and drug crime on the reservations. You guys were paying attention. I like that. Because if you remember earlier, I said, where did I go to do the illegal things I was doing? The reservations. So my very first case that came across my desk, and this was in November, and I'm 11 and a half months coming apart at the seams with untreated alcoholism. 11 and a half months, the very first case that I got was someone I knew very well. And they were all very, very excited. They thought they had caught the biggest drug dealer on the reservation. They hadn't. I'm just saying. I didn't tell them that, but they hadn't. So I had to, I couldn't prosecute him because I had been in the room with him doing things I wasn't supposed to be doing. And heaven help me if, you know, sitting at tables like this and I'm here at the prosecutor and D, we called him D, would be over there with his defense attorney and he'd look over and say, hey, you know. And Your Honor, I can tell you a whole lot about your prosecutor here. I couldn't afford for him to see my name on anything. Later, I did find out he knew. He knew. So, and I want to tell you, I saw him about 2 years ago. He got out of prison. And I asked him, why didn't you say anything? And he said, because you were always nice to me. He went to prison. I wasn't nice to him. He had what I wanted. And it killed me. He went to prison. But when I saw him a couple years ago, he was a couple years sober. Yeah. It was pretty cool. We got to hug. And he forgave me and I did amends. But I can't believe the sacrifice. He didn't say anything. But anyway, I disclosed. We do what we say, we disclosed. And so I said I knew this person, and boy, it was like the sirens went off and doors slammed and everybody, I mean, it was just crazy. Because they knew you can't know someone like this unless you're involved in that world. And the U.S. attorney flew in on his jet. They had three FBI agents in there. They had two other assistant U.S. attorneys. That's what I was. So two of them and the U.S. attorney, three FBI, six men in suits doing the good cop, bad cop interrogation for 3 hours. I did not crack. I pulled out my program, and Vigorous Honesty had nowhere in the ballpark of my program. Not at that point. I had no program. I just had the just don't drink program. So I am throwing everything out there. I'm like, well, you know, on the reservation, we're all related. And, you know, he's just like I'm not even native, okay? But I'm using anything I can. So the bottom line is we're not through with you. This isn't over yet. We will be talking to you. You may as well never come back to work again. We can't fire you yet. Can't arrest you yet. But you haven't heard the end of it. Don't come back to work. I went home. I'm 3 weeks away from, even though I made all this money, I was $90,000 when I got sober. And of course, at the beginning, I didn't do any amends or didn't do a program. So at that point, even after... In November, I'm $90,000 in credit card debt alone. I'm living on credit because I was using my paycheck to buy the things I needed to buy. In 3 weeks, my rent was due. I had no savings. I had no money. In 3 weeks, my car payment was due. I have no money. In 3 weeks, my Harley payment's due. I have no money. They're coming to take everything. I'm going to be homeless in 3 weeks. I go out to my car in the parking lot, and I break down, and I'm crying that cry that it's like your life is over. I've destroyed everything. And my thought was, fine. I'll go down to the reservation, and I'll do what I need to do to get what I need to get until I can't take it anymore, and I'll either go out fast or slow. I had, at that point, a loaded pistol. I was so miserable, in sobriety, dry, and I was about to take my life anyway because I could not stand how I felt sober. So I'm going to go down to the reservation, and I'll either do it quickly or do, like I planned, or I'll do it slowly by drinking myself to death. But that's my best thinking. A lot of people say, yeah, my best thinking got me into AA. That's not my story. My best thinking gets me drunk and dead. That's my best thinking. I did nothing to get here. It's not my best thinking, because right on the heels of my thinking about going to the reservation, doing what I need to do to get what I need to get and then end it, right on the heels of that was a thought that was not from me, and it was, I hear they have good AA in Rapid City. And I said, okay, fine. I'm talking to a God I despise and don't believe in. Fine. I'll go there, but you got one chance. One chance, and then I'm going to do the reservation plan. So I packed up my stuff. I went to Rapid City, and I walked in there, and the AA community there saw that I was dying, and they went into overdrive. I have a male sponsor. There was a lot of females there, no females that were sponsoring. My sponsor got the short straw. No one wanted me at all. He's a, get this, Harley mechanic. He really didn't like me. So he kicked my butt through the steps, and that was where my journey started. And I did what I had the gift of desperation, because I was dying sober. And I had that gift of desperation unlike any that I had experienced before. It was either do it or die for me. And so I did. And yes, I balked a little bit at the third step prayer. And he said, I don't care what you think about God. I don't care how you feel. Do it anyway. And I was like, well, you know how what I think. You don't want me to be a hypocrite, do you? And he says, I know you, and I know your list of character defects, and hypocrites way down here. I don't think we have anything to worry about. So do it anyway. So I was on my knees, and I did start that. And I just want to, okay, so I did, and I did it so imperfectly. I did what I was told, right? I know more about this theology thing than you guys, right? I mean, that's what I thought when I came in here. From the wee child on up, I was forced to memorize chapters of that other good book. I had that, right? And I had a doctorate of theology as a father. I knew this stuff. And I was highly educated, don't you know, right? I got all these degrees. And my sponsors and mechanics. I thought I knew more than all of you. And so I didn't think it was going to work. And I didn't think it was going to work for me. And I never thought I would laugh again. I hadn't laughed for a decade without some substance or alcohol in me, that fake laugh. I didn't laugh until well over my first year of sobriety, because remember, that first year I wasn't doing anything. And I thought my life was over, but it's like, what the hell, I'll give them six months. And if I'm not fixed in 6 months, I'm out of here. I can't stand it. So I started doing it anyway, and the wonderful thing about this program is that it works even when you don't do it perfectly. I get to stop competing. I get to stop debating. I get to, for once, be humble and follow directions. My sponsor used to say, your need to be right is going to kill you. See, I'm trained to be right. I get paid to be right. Your need to be right is going to kill you. And so I just started following the instructions. And yes, I did make amends to both husbands. I made amends to my family. I think people always ask me, did you make amends to the person's car that you crashed in? No. But I don't know who they are. But I have made amends in other ways to other people with vehicles. But I got through the steps. And I want to tell you something. If you have a problem with the higher power thing, that's fine. I did too. And I just did the best I could for 4 years in sobriety. And you know what? It worked, because God doesn't make too hard of terms for those who seek Him. And God met me where I was. Met me where I was. And it worked. And it worked, but I'll tell you something. I want to tell you a real quick story, and I promise I may end with that. At 4 years sober, I was in Jamestown. I had just moved back in 2011 to North Dakota. I was jumping into AA up there. It was a whole, they did it wrong in North Dakota. I had to straighten that out very quickly. No, I was in a roundup, and I was in Jamestown at a roundup, and everybody had left. It was noon. It was that break between noon and dinner, and I saw this little guy, and he had a speaker ribbon on, and no one was there. No one was there. And I had been trained to be polite in AA. And so I went up to him and I said, are you okay? Do you have a host? He goes, I don't know where anyone is. And I said, well, you can come with me and my girls and we're going to go to dinner. And he said, okay. And so we went to dinner. And we the dinner conversation started talking about the third step. Now, I do the third step on my knees every day, right? And it did bring benefits to me. But we're talking about it, and he shared his third step prayer. And he said what he prays every day was, or is, God, surprise me today. Lead me where you need me. And I looked at him. He's very short. So I looked down at him. And he's like 70 years old or whatever. And I said, oh my gosh, isn't that a terrifying prayer? I mean, I was horrified. Surprise me today. I don't get a vote on a surprise. I don't know when it's coming. I don't know if I'm going to like it. Are you freaking kidding me? Isn't that terrifying? And he looks up at me. And he said, oh no, sweetie. God only wants my highest good. And the conversation continued, but I felt like someone had gotten a baseball bat and just wham, right across my chest. The air just went out of me. I sat back. No one knew what was going on. No one was noticing, but I sat back, and it occurred to me, I am still terrified of God. So, of course, I'm not going to give anything over to the care and control of something I think is going to hurt me. So from that moment on, from 4 years sober, from that moment on, I went on a search to find a new concept, to discard all that stuff that I had been raised with. Not saying it's bad for them, but I couldn't access it. I had to shed all that, discard all that. And I watched parents of toddlers and puppy dog owners. And I watched how they treated their puppies and how they treated their children. And I gained a new concept of what my parent, my new employer, may treat me like. And it was a game changer. The third step is a game changer for me. And today I get to live in steps 10, 11, and 12, which is a daily thing of all the steps, 10 and 11 and 12, 10 all through the day. I get to promptly admit when I'm wrong, ooh, which is really hard. And I get to make amends, and I get to clean it up, and I get to stay current. Step 10 is to help me live with you all, which has always been very hard for me, because you just don't do what I want you to do, ever. Step 11, prayer and meditation. Meditation has become very, very important to me in prayer. Meditation is to get me right with God. And step 12 is to do that in all my affairs, to practice these principles in all my affairs, no matter what it is. You, me, God, there's no one else to play with. I know I'm done. So I gotta, I just wanna, in case you didn't get anything, out of this, I just want to read this one thing, and this is what you all, this is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Meetings are fantastic, but this book is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to tell you what this program contained in this book has done for me. AA has filled my days with friends, laughter, growth, and the feeling of worth that is rooted in constructive activity. My faith in and contact with my higher power shines more brightly than I dreamed it could. Those promises I thought were impossible are a viable force in my life.
I am free to laugh all of my laughter, free to trust and be trusted, free to both give and receive help. I am free from shame and regret, free to learn and grow and work. I have left that lonely, frightening, painful express train through hell. I have accepted the gift of a safer, happier journey through life. Thank you for my life.